You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash!
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
I am Troy Olson, and I am, of course, joined by my partners in crime, Michael Engel. Mike, how you doing?
I'm pretty good. A little stuffed up, but for the most part, pretty good.
And, of course, our second partner in crime, Jeff Herr. How's it going, man?
Oh, I'm fantastic, as always.
We're going to get right down to business this week, talking about two prospect lists came out this week, one out on MLB.com and the other one out on Baseball Prospectus. Both very good publications, but had some pretty different lists. Jeff, what did you think of the lists?
No, it was something where it was kind of weird, because you look at the Baseball Prospectus list had seven players from the Royals on it, and then was it four or five on the MLB list? Mm-hmm. They said Manaea and Starling just barely missed, and Starling wasn't even one of the seven that were on the Baseball Prospectus list. And it just, from the ones that were on and where they were ranked, you had Ventura and Zimmer. I mean, those are pretty much universally, most consider those the two highest prospects. But at the same time, Baseball Prospectus has put a lot of weight, specifically Jason Parksom. So he's talked a lot about Raul Mondesi and how much of a ceiling this guy has. And so it just was kind of interesting to me that it seemed more like MLB.com, coming from the major league perspective, looks more at players who they can, more easily say this will be a major league player and will have a chance of being a good major league player, versus the Baseball Prospectus angle, which kind of takes that scout viewpoint where they say, okay, this person might not guarantee at the major league level, but at the same time, they've got tools, they've got a skill set that is going to put them in position to, if they continue to refine their skills, they can be a very good player. And it's more of a MLB seems to kind of look at the player overall and how they project, versus Baseball Prospectus looking at right now, here's their skill set, here's how it matches up against the rest of players at their position, players in their leagues, players in all of minor league baseball, and where does that slot them in terms of who's best, and how can then the question becomes, how can those skills project into the major leagues? Whereas it looks like MLB.com has kind of a different approach to it. And this isn't necessarily, this is just my kind of observation. It's not necessarily something that either side has come out and said, but it makes sense too, because you've got MLB.com is a lot of the journalists, they have those MLB.com beat reporters that cover all the teams, and the different journalists that write for them, versus Baseball Prospectus that's coming from that scouting angle, those people that came up as kind of a more scouts than journalists, but they also had that skill of being able to write and do it creatively. And so it's just a real interesting dichotomy when you look at that, because normally you'll see, I think the Baseball America, Baseball Prospectus, those lists are usually pretty close, but the MLB one usually differs quite a bit. And it's just kind of interesting to me when you really take a step back and look at it and say, okay, why is this different? And I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, a good example of that is like right after the Royals traded Jonathan Broxton to the Reds for J.C. Sobron and Donnie Joseph, the next up that they had to the top 10 prospects included both of those guys. So it kind of seemed like they want to jump in and get those, guys who are close to the majors right up there right away, so that, okay, you can point to them more, sooner than any other players that might be coming up. It's also interesting to see which names were left off of MLB.com's top 100 that made the BP, because those are guys, Sean Manaea is one guy who, the more I hear about him, the more excited I get. Kind of have to hold myself back and temper myself, because he's a pitching prospect in the Royal system. So there's always some ominous sign with those guys. But then Hunter Dozier, you know, another guy who just got drafted last year as well, and Miguel Almonte was left off of MLB's top 100, and he's 46th on BP's. So I think that's a really big gap between, you know, both sites on just that one player. But all three of those guys, Almonte, Minaya, and Dozier, are more recent into the kind of prospect scene. Zimmer was a top five pick two drafts ago, and you know, Ventura has been a big name, and, you know, All-Star Futures Game participant twice, and Mondesi has been really high. So, you know, it's interesting to see those differences and kind of see, you know, what comes out of those. Going back to Minaya, this is a, you know, the Royals kind of took a risk last year in the draft, and they drafted Hunter Dozier, who everybody was like immediately panning because it looked like a complete overdraft. But it allowed them to sign Dozier at a good amount, you know, for a guy, but still under the slot. And they used that money to go sign Sean Minaya, who had slipped back through the entire first round. He was the Royals pick in their competitive balance draft selection. And they gave him a good signing bonus, but he was projected to be at the front of the first round in that draft, but it was injury problems. He had a hip issue that everybody knew about that has since been corrected, and he seems ahead of schedule. That's really exciting. So Jim Callis was on Twitter, and he said that next year Minaya could be about number 25 overall if he's able to pitch like he did in the Cape Cod League. And Callis said that his fastball was nearly unhittable. Jason Parks in a chat today said that Minaya is both healthy and nasty, and it looks like he's going to be pitching probably in Lexington or Wilmington and getting a full season of minor league baseball next year, which, you know, if he starts in Wilmington, that's a pretty fast track because that's only two more levels until the big leagues. And you could definitely easily see him like late 2015, maybe, you know, early 2016 or something. He could be like a Michael Wacha, a guy who just jumps through and dominates right away. So that's really exciting, and that looks like a really good steal from last year's draft. And it's kind of strange to see that MLB.com didn't have him involved, you know, a little higher.
I thought that was a really good, a really interesting point about Minaya, Mike, that it's just it's a shrewd move that the Royals should get credit for, because, and that's the kind of thing that the Royals with the new salary cap, or not salary cap, draft cap structure and how that works going forward. This is something, these types of moves are the things the Royals are going to have to start doing more of. All small market teams will have to start doing. And hopefully, you know, if Minaya pays off, they can get more of that payoff like this. Because I think it was a very good move, and it's a very good point.
Any thoughts on Bubba Starling being left off the list?
I don't know, but I mean, we've talked about Bubba enough. I think we just kind of see what happens, have to see what happens. If he makes it, great. But it's tough to have expectations for him. You know, if he does meet, you know, any of those expectations, you're looking good because he's a five tool type of guy. As long as he can, you know, one of those tools is the hit tool. So I don't know. I'm iffy on Starling. I don't think you can count on him. I don't think you can really put him in a lineup in a couple of years. But I also have always kind of thought that once it clicks with him, it's going to click in a big way. So you could start seeing that, but I think it's 50-50. I really don't know that you can rely too much on him. I think you have to have backup plans. And I think the Royals kind of do. I think Bonifacio is a good prospect. Dozier's probably not going to stick at third. I think he's more of a corner outfield guy eventually. So that's, you know, those are two plans right there that you can kind of get away with. And, you know, Lane Adams just keeps getting better and better too, and getting a lot of accolades and attention. He's somebody else to kind of keep in mind, and, you know, plus whoever else they might draft this year.
Yordano Ventura wins the Pitcher of the Year Award, which is known as the Paul Splitter Award. You know, this is a big award for him. It had a great second half and then comes out and wins this award. What does this all mean for the kid going forward?
Well, he had a really good year. I mean, you look at all the Royals prospects, the pitching prospects who have come up, and they always seem to hit a wall around Double A, and Ventura didn't. And that makes him pretty special just in this organization, because he just kept going. He had a good year in Double A. They got promoted him to Triple A. He continued to be really good. You know, he made an appearance in the All-Star Futures game again, ended up getting a call up in September. And, you know, two of his three starts, he pitched pretty well. And I think that, you know, the kind of rankings that they have on here, I think there's a lot of people that are still skeptical he's going to be able to remain a starter. And I think that's fair because he still has to, you know, you want him to be a kind of guy who can throw 200 innings. And his size is something that people are always going to see as limiting. There are fewer exceptions to the small pitcher rule as far as starters. So you want to see him kind of actually do it before you can really peg him as an actual starting pitcher. I think he's going to be okay. Jason Parks loves him. I think he pegged him as one of the front runner for the 2014 AL Rookie of the Year. So that bodes pretty well. Obviously, that still has to happen, and the Splitorf Award is, you know, going off of 2013, and I think he had the best year of any Royals pitching prospect. So it's just paying off the guy who did a great job.
Ventura has long been, for me, the most fascinating prospect in this system for the exact reason that Mike said, how they mostly hit a wall at AA, and he just hasn't. And it's like, against all odds, he's the little pitcher that could. I mean, the Royal system that just chews up pitchers and spits them out, you know, never to return again. And then here he is, you know, making things happen, winning pitcher of the year, you know, like just looking really good and hasn't really slowed down. Injuries haven't been a problem. I think he'll be a starter. I mean, I think from what I have heard, from what Jason Parks has said on our show, from what I've read, from what Parks has written, from what other scouts have written, I mean, the fastball is elite, you know, like, I mean, you look at, I can't remember when when the individual team rankings came out from baseball prospectus. And I mean, I think they rated his fastball like a 7 right now with an 8 ceiling. And I mean, they only go up to 8. So, I mean, that's basically saying that he could have the best fastball in the league, you know, if he keeps working with the command and gets even better at it. When you combine that with what they said about how, you know, he's got a, you know, his secondary pitches, his curveball, changeup aren't great, but they're both good and getting better and continuing to improve. And that's how he continues to get better at each level, because he's getting better. You know, it's not necessarily a factor of competition or, you know, something like that. So I do think he'll be a starter. I think that the war with going on right now between people, you know, the, oh, he's going to be a starter, he's going to be a reliever thing. I can't, who is it? I think it's BH and Dev Mo or whatever on Twitter just will not give up on Ventura being a reliever. Just does not think he'll. And it's just a battle of conventional wisdom versus what you actually see with your eyes. You know, like conventional wisdom says a guy who's 5'10", 170 pounds, and throws with a high effort delivery with a 100-mile-an-hour fastball is going to be a reliever, because in 1975, if that's what you looked like, then that's what you were, you know. And to a large extent, that's the way a lot of people still operate. But at the same time, you know, at some point, you got to say, okay, well, I mean, this guy's doing it. He threw a lot of innings last year. I believe last year was a career high for him in innings. I can't remember the exact figure off the top of my head. Mike, do you know how many?
It was about 140 off the top of my head. Yeah. I don't have it in front of me either.
Which, you know, I mean, if you want to get, so I mean, they're not going to get 200 innings out of him next year, but I don't think it's a stretch to say they could probably get 150, 160 innings out of him next year at the major league level, assuming he can continue to hack it. And if that's the case, you know, then you're looking at someone who can easily project to being a starter. And if you're in that 180 to 200 innings range and you can consistently put that out, I mean, you're consistently going to be a starter. You might not be, I mean, you obviously want, if you want that elite level Justin Verlander type, you know, you're going to be, you want the 220 innings, you know, that type of a thing at that elite level. But I mean, how many people are like that? You know, not very many. I happen to think that there is a good future for Yordano Ventura as a starter, just based on what I know. I've been wrong a million times before, you know, so I was on the Mike Montgomery bandwagon for so long. So,
oh man,
I mean, we all know how that turned out. So I've definitely been wrong before, but that's, I think he can stay. And I think a lot of the people that don't think he can stay, I mean, I think there are, I mean, there's always doubts with every pitcher. I think there's a reasonable doubt. Can they translate what they have at the minor league level to the major league? There has to be. Just the way the system works, there simply has to be. So I totally understand that. But I also think a lot of people that are just guaranteeing, you know, oh, he's going to be a reliever. I don't even know why they're still messing with him as starter. You know, those people are out there. I think that is just a battle of the conventional wisdom versus what we're actually seeing and what his skill set actually is.
Yeah, and the other thing that interests me is he's not, you know, he throws 100-some miles an hour. He's got a pretty good curveball that's getting better, changeup that's getting better. But he's a pitcher. He's not just a thrower. I mean, compare him to a guy like Jeremy Jeffress, who another guy can hit triple digits like nothing. Like, it's, you know, every, like clockwork. You know, he can do it all the time. Had a nasty curveball, too, with ton of break. And he didn't really have any idea where it was going. You know, he couldn't pinpoint it. He wouldn't change speeds. And ended up getting him out of the Royals organization, and he's bounced around a little bit. You know, now I think teams don't know what to do with him. Ventura doesn't have that problem. Ventura has been able to pitch basically as long as he's been a pro. And so the Royals have something really nice there, in that they have a guy that with this wicked stuff, and they don't really have to worry about if he can actually use it. They just have to figure out how they can use it.
So Lane Adams wins the Hitter of the Year Award, which is known as the George Brett Hitter of the Year Award. And this is a big deal for him because this is a guy that started out in single A, worked his way through double A, and then did the playoffs with triple A. Jeff, do you think it's a big deal that this kid made moves through so many levels in this one last season?
I mean, I would say so. I mean, that's going to be, you know, anytime you can jump multiple levels within the span of a year and you're winning organizational awards. I mean, especially from a guy who, he was one of those guys where you're not going to expect, you know, elite level play from, but he's a guy who you think, okay, he's somebody that can probably at some point might be able to make it to the major leagues and give us some valuable innings and some valuable play, but nobody you're going to depend on. And he just, you know, one of those guys where you have him in every organization, every step of the way, where people doubt him and say, oh, you know, they did well in low A, but they're probably not going to do that well in high A, or it's going to catch up to him. And he just keeps succeeding. So, I mean, if he just keeps doing it, they're going to have to find a place for him. I mean, that's just the way it goes. You know, either that or they'll trade him to somebody who will find a place for him. So, I mean, I think definitely probably the best year of his life. And yeah, I mean, it's exciting when you have – I mean, if you look at – like I said, the St. Louis Cardinals from last year, I mean, they had so many players from just a couple drafts, you know, 2009 in particular, that were just really helping that team out. And it's because they find guys like a Lane Adams, you know, who's like a Pete Cosma type. I don't know. You know, I don't know where they were relative to their draft skill sites or whatever. But, you know, people that are just unheralded, and then all of a sudden they kind of come out of nowhere, and it's like, oh, hey, you know, this guy can actually play. So, you know, maybe Lane Adams is that guy. Because the Royals, like, it seems they never have those guys that you don't.
No, they never do.
You know, and it's a fault of their organization. So it would be really great to see them have one and to see it be in the form of Lane Adams.
So with Lane Adams being such a speed guy, could you see them just bringing him up and using him in sort of a Dyson role?
I don't know if you could do it right now, but I think eventually, yeah, he could be a guy that's in that conversation. He's bigger than Dyson. He's, you know, 6'2" guy, so he looks more like what you kind of expect an outfielder to look like. You know, he's also – he needs to hit a little bit more. You know, his career minor league batting average is .265, and, you know, batting average isn't everything, but it does help, obviously. But the other thing is his career on base percentage in the minors is about .339. So he's good at finding ways to get on base. And when he gets on base, he's stolen 95 bases in 111 attempts. So that's that speed. And even better, the last two seasons, he's reached double digits in home runs in 135 games in 2012 and 131 games last year. So he's got a little bit of pop, too. So that's more to his benefit. If you've got a guy who can get on base, has some power, and has speed, that's going to be a pretty valuable player, even if they're just a fourth outfielder. I could definitely see him having some kind of career kind of like David Lowe. He's 24 years old now, so it could be, you know, he makes his major league debut at 25, 26, you know, puts in a couple of good years, contributes, and maybe catches on somewhere as a platoon guy or something. I don't think you're going to see him turn into a star, but he can contribute, and he's just getting better. And as he goes up the level, you know, he's not really hitting any kind of a problem. Like, he's not suddenly dropping out and not getting on base. You know, that's something you saw with Johnny Giovitella, where he could get on base and draw walks up until he reached the majors, and then he wasn't doing it anymore. That's kind of going to be the next test. So we'll see a little bit of Lane Adams in spring training, and you know, maybe in September, maybe early next season. I don't know. It's, you know, he's definitely interesting, and he's done a good job of getting himself back up into that conversation.
Well, I think Lane makes it up this year in September because on his speed alone, he's just too valuable to leave him down in the minors. And I think we're going to see him make a big impact on the AL Central race. Speaking of the AL Central race, here we are getting ready for the season. And the AL Central is really kind of up in the air right now. I mean, the Indians aren't very good, but Ubaldo might come back for $14 million, which would help them out a lot. We'll talk more about that later. And, you know, the White Sox aren't very good. They don't look like they're going anywhere. The Twins are going to be good in a couple of years. They have a great farm system, but nothing going on right now. And then there's the Tigers. Who knows what you're going to get out of the Tigers? Fielder's gone. Kinsler comes in. But really, where does that improve them at? Jeff, what do you got going on in the Central?
Well, I think right now, it's going to be about pretty much a repeat of how it was last year. I think the Tigers, well, I shouldn't say a repeat, because I don't think the Tigers are going to quite run away with it necessarily. Because, yeah, like you said, I don't think the Tigers, I don't think they're much worse, but they definitely haven't gotten any better. Because they made the Prince Fielder for Ian Kinsler trade, so that might make them a tad bit better on paper. And then, you know, Justin Verlander's had some injuries. I'm not sure if he's going to be ready for the season opener or not.
He might not be.
Because the prognosis hasn't exactly been stellar on his recovery timetable from his what kind of shirt did he have? I cannot remember what kind of surgery he had.
It was something in his core. It was I didn't see specifically, but it's something in his midsection, which is pretty important for a pitcher, for any athlete, really. So,
you know, I mean, the Tigers are not without their issues. And then the Indians.
And they traded away Doug Fister, too, for nothing, basically.
Can't forget that, yes.
Yeah.
And then the Indians, I mean, they just kind of came out of nowhere last year. I mean, we talked about this in the show. I remember we were just kind of like, oh, yeah, the Indians are just going to kind of mail it in and rebuild. And then all of a sudden, it's just like one day they said, you know what, screw that. And then let's sign Michael Bourne and let's sign all these players. And then, you know, it paid off. You know, they got that second wild card spot and, you know, made a run at it. And so I think that, you know, I'm not sure how much better the Indians will be either. You know, I think in terms of improving year over year, I think the Royals have the best chance of improving, even with the loss of Irvin Santana. Because, I mean, the Santana loss seems huge, you know, and it is. But when you kind of take a step back and you look at it and say, okay, Jason Vargas versus Irvin Santana, what if Jason Vargas is 75% of what Irvin Santana was, which, you know, would not be that great of a pitcher, even if, you know, even though Santana was really good, that would just be maybe an average pitcher. And then you take the gains of Aoki and Infante over the black holes that were in those positions last year, and you say, okay, lump all those three players together, you know, year over year, what's the difference? I haven't crunched the numbers. I probably should at some point. But I do think, you know, it might not be as big of a drop off as people are predicting. I think I'm going to stick with my year. I mean, all that said, I think I'll probably end up sticking with my year over year prediction, make the same one as last year and sit at 85 games. But I do think in terms of outlook from the Central, I think the Royals have the biggest chance of making the biggest or the best chance of making the biggest improvement, if that makes sense. And then you look at coming out today, these farm systems, you have the Twins have the best farm system in the Central. And, you know, depending on who you ask, they probably could have the best in all of Major League Baseball. And then the Royals are kind of pretty close, still like that sort of top five-ish system. And then after that, it's nothing. I mean, I think there's three players total on the top 100 baseball prospectus list from the remaining three teams, and the White Sox don't even have any. So, I mean, the Royals right now are positioned to, you know, go forward the Royals are in a pretty good position to make a run at this for not just 1 year, but for a couple. I mean, they've got people like the Hosmers and Moustakas until 2017, and you've got Danny Duffy, Yordano Ventura, Kyle Zimmer. These guys are coming up. They're looking a little bit better than that previous wave of prospects actually at this point in their careers. So, if those things start to fall and the Royals actually catch a break, I know it's a novel concept, but if the Royals actually catch a break with some prospects, I mean, you could be looking at, the Tigers are only getting older and their farm system isn't that great either. So, of course, they've got the money so they can go out and buy people that, they can sign the Prince Fielders and stuff when they don't have anybody to come up. But all the same, I think the Royals are in good position. And this year, I don't know. I mean, I still don't think it's their year. I think that, the same amount of wins is definitely reasonable and should be the expectation, but I don't know if this is the year they make the jump. And to be honest, I don't know until I see a lot more. I don't know if I can say with any certainty when it is, but if it comes up this year and Yordano Ventura is what we hope he can be, and then maybe at the end of the year Kyle Zimmer comes up and throws a few starts and he looks pretty good, then you might look to 2015, even though they'll lose James Shields. But you might look at that and say, okay, maybe this is a year they can make a stride. But who knows? We'll see. But I do think it'll be pretty similar to last year with the Central. I think the Tigers probably still have the best team, but the gap is not quite as wide as it once was.
So this week we had the ZIP projections come out, which are normally pretty accurate and something that people really look to. And then we also had a founder of BP weighing in on his opinion, and he did not give the Royals much credit this year.
Yeah, and I think with these projections, the way that Clay Davenport kind of presents them on his site, it's just you can find them on claydavenport.com. He does specify that these are first projections, so I think they're going to run different ones. And a lot of it is based off of run differential, so going off of Pythagorean kind of principles. And comparing last year's production in those areas to what it projects is kind of where you see where this difference is, because last year the Royals scored 648 runs, and Davenport's projections, they do project the Royals to be better than that. Has them projected for 680 runs scored, which is a good jump. But the real difference is going to be in runs against, because the Royals only allowed 601 runs last year, which is phenomenal. It's very good. And it's going to be difficult to keep that up, especially when you lose Irvin Santana. You kind of have to assume Greg Holland's not going to be as lights out, because it was probably a career year. Luke Hochever, I don't think you can go in assuming he's going to be as good as he was last year. So, you'll see a little bit of a drop off there probably. What you get out of this projections, it does see that the Royals, they project the Royals to give up a lot more runs. And it could be something where, if Hochever's put in as a starter, he is going to give up more runs. I mean, we've seen what he can do as a starter. And even if he's just average, he's just going to give up a lot of runs. It's just, compared to last year, there's just no other way around it. So I don't know. It's important to kind of look at these as projections and not predictions. The way that Dan Zimborski does his Zips projections is really trying to compare players to, similar types of players who have, the kind of, history of production. You weight it differently depending on, the most recent seasons. And then you kind of look at where they are age-wise. And then you try to find a comparison and see how some of those guys did. And that's kind of how they generate them. And that's kind of, so they're just comparisons to, the historical stats that are out there. And you just throw them all in a computer and it spits out, kind of different things. Some of the guys, it does project Mike Moustakas to be better. It projects Alcides Escobar to be at least from awful to not as bad. Eric Hosmer, it still sees is doing pretty well. Billy Butler's kind of standing in the same spot. Alex Gordon, really thinks that he's going to be better. So you just kind of have to look at that as, this is just another tool to kind of look at what might happen. I think that the basis behind projections are pretty sound. You know, these guys spend a lot of time thinking about him. And Davenport, you know, he's a BP guy. Zimborski is really, really smart, and he's been doing these projections for years now. So I think that they've done them well enough. You can't say that this is what's going to happen, and I think that's what people try to call them out on all the time, that this is what's going to happen. But it's what is probably most likely to happen under these conditions. So, and any of those things can really change. I mean, if you know, Ventura comes up and is lights out as a starter, that's something that the Royals can benefit from. If Duffy gets his control figured out, that's another thing. And then you've got, you know, where you're looking at Shields, Ventura, Duffy as your top three pitchers rather than Shields, Vargas, Guthrie, which is a big change, because then all those guys have to be is around average and you're doing okay. And so that's, you know, something that you just can't predict. People break out all the time. People have, you know, strange career years. Or, you know, maybe James Shields gets hurt and, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. So you just kind of have to let it run its course. I think it's important to look at this information because it's taking a look at, you know, history, and there's enough history of baseball, and it's always been documented in the history of baseball. Stats have always been a part of baseball pretty much from the start, so that you can't really just dismiss them. You just have to kind of acknowledge that you can't predict it. So they're just projections, not predictions. And that's a key point that I would point out to anybody who might be freaking out at that 77-85 mark, because I don't think that's – I don't see how it can go that way. The Royals didn't – they got better on offense. The bad players that were there at the start of the year last year are no longer around. And while I don't like Jason Vargas, he's at least average. He's not going to hurt you quite like probably Wade Davis would have all year. He's not going to be Irvin Santana, but I think he's going to be okay enough that, you know, the Royals aren't going to just fall off the face of the earth.
It was a good point that you made, Mike, to bring up the difference between prediction and projection. You know, I mean, Nick, you can only go off of what we know, and what they know is, you know, definable.
It's what happens.
Exactly. What happens.
That's pretty much it, yeah.
You've got your last, you know, they give certain weights and they try and, you know, allow for regression and possible improvements and things like that. And they do factor those into these models. But, I mean, you only have what you have, and it's a good starting point. And you talked about the prevalence of stats in baseball. And I think the big part of that is that it has more of a place in baseball than any others, just because there's so many more opportunities for things that the averages play out more.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it a lot easier for numbers to actually make sense and to actually have some sort of predictive value year over year more often. But, you know, it's still not a true prediction. It's just, mm-hmm. This is how we kind of think things could go. And, you know, that's a point that I think people kind of, like you said, people try and call them out on it, and I think they kind of miss the boat on that. And it's an important distinction to make. So I just wanted to highlight that. I think that was a good point that you brought up, Mike, that people need to keep in mind.
So let's switch and talk a little bit about starting pitching and what's left out there. Boy, Mike, Tanaka got paid, didn't he?
He did.
Certainly did.
Oh, God. I mean, you could see it just a couple of days later. I mean, Tanaka signed, and he was what was holding up all these starting pitchers. There's so many good starting pitchers that were still unsigned here at the end of January. And then right after he signs, Matt Garza goes and signs with the Brewers, who was one of the top guys, probably the most attractive starting pitching free agent out there, just because he won't cost a team a draft pick. But, I mean, he's a guy, you know, he's got a good track record. He's been pretty consistent. The only kind of knock on him is that he's been injury prone. But he's a good pitcher, and he was able to sign for a pretty good deal for the Brewers, who got him for 4 years and $50 million. And so those are the top two pitchers off the board. And so Tanaka, he's kind of in a class of his own. He's, you know, in his mid-20s and the phenom of sorts. So he was going to get paid, and he's definitely – you can't really set the market off of him, but he can open it up now because teams aren't waiting to see where he's going to go or if they're going to be able to get him. And so now Garza's signing is kind of the first one of those reaction signings that, okay, now Tanaka's gone, you can go sign him. And so now the next two in line are Irvin Santana and Ubaldo Jimenez. And that's what makes it interesting.
So, Jeff, you get to be Dayton Moore. how much do you give Eduardo Jimenez and Irving Santana, and who do you really want out of that group?
For me, if to start with Irving Santana, this is coming from a standpoint of he had a great year last year, but if I look at Irving Santana from his career, I see someone who has been incredibly inconsistent. And he'll have very good – I believe he only has 2 years of back-to-back ERAs below four. Every other year in his career, if he was below four, he was above four, or even, you know, in the fives. So that kind of inconsistency on a pitcher who, you know, right at that point where you're kind of coming on the precipice of the peak of his career, he's probably going to be on the downslide. So if it's just me and baseball, we're normal sport in terms of contracts, which it's not, and we're going to have that as a topic on a show because I can go off on that for a long time. But anyway, I would go, like, my initial inclination is 3 years, $36 million for someone like Irving Santana. But I would know that's a little, you know, on the low side in terms of what he would be expecting in the market. So I'd probably bump it to like 3 years, $39 million. I think that's okay because I don't want to go longer than 3 years on a guy like Irving Santana because, like I said, he's in his early 30s. He's getting close to the downside of his career, and he's been inconsistent anyway. So, I mean, if you're signing him to a three-year deal, there is a chance that only one of those years do you get an above-average pitcher. One of those years you probably get an average, and you could get a real stinker of a year out of those three. So, you know, and that all, you're just hoping that it all aligns to where – he has that really good year in the same year that everybody else does. So, I mean, there's a lot more risk in there. Everyone just assumes because he did it last year that he's going to do the same thing this year. And I think the park plays to his strengths. I think the defense plays to his strengths. So, I mean, I think there's a better chance of repeating what he did last year at Kauffman than there is in the majority of the parks in the rosters in the league. But at the same time, he has been inconsistent, and I don't know how much faith I have in him. So I'm not as – I want Irving Santana back if the Royals can afford him. I don't want to overpay for anybody, but especially not for someone like Irving Santana just because of the inconsistency that he's had in his career. Now, if you want to talk Ubaldo Jimenez, I mean, he's been a little bit more consistent than Irving Santana, and he's younger. I mean, he literally just turned 30. So, I mean, if you think of pitchers hit their prime a little bit earlier than hitters. So, like, normally your hitter that, you know, that 26, 27 into their, you know, 31, 32, 33 range, that range is their prime for a hitter, whereas a pitcher probably peaks a little bit earlier. So you've got a better chance of getting a couple more of the really good years at the end of his peak if you sign a Jimenez versus signing someone like a Santana. You know, that said, a couple of years ago, Jimenez had a really bad year, you know, just like Santana did. So it's possible he's kind of figured things out. And for someone like Jimenez, I mean, he hasn't pitched more than 188 innings in the last 3 years. So, you know, he's not exactly giving you a ton of innings. He's not, which is something that Santana has done better. So, I mean, I'd probably do a very similar deal. I could go, like, I might go three years, $42 million for Jimenez simply because he's younger and there's the odds of getting those above average, very good years out of that contract are better than with Santana. And I just, with a pitcher, unless it's Clayton Kershaw or Justin Verlander in his prime, going over 3 years on a pitcher, it's just a risky proposition no matter who it is. I mean, there's maybe 10% of the pitchers in Major League Baseball that you'd feel comfortable going over. You know, David Price comes on the market next year. I'm comfortable going over 3 years on a contract for David Price.
Well,
but
that's not really fair.
Well, I mean, then Clayton Kershaw, you know, if I'm the Dodgers, like, taking the money out of it, just the length of the contract,
yeah,
7 years, I'm comfortable with that for Clayton Kershaw. But I am not comfortable signing Irving Santana for 7 years, not even close to it. I'm not comfortable signing Jimenez for 7 years, not close to it. I wouldn't sign Doug Fister for 7 years. You know, Max Scherzer even just won the Cy Young. I wouldn't wouldn't sign him to 7 years. So, I mean, it takes a pretty elite pitcher to feel good about making that commitment. So I'm not going over 3 years on anybody, especially not those two.
Now, Jeff's talking about the value of players based on their contracts and what have you, and there's a nice little stat that baseball has called WAR, wins above replacement, and our partners over at the Walk-Off Talk, boy, I would have been in trouble for forgetting that name. Ben and Andre do a really good job on a segment called Stat of the Day. I wish we'd have thought of this. This is such a great segment, and I really encourage people to listen to that show, if for no other reason, for that segment, because it's honestly taught me some that I didn't know. But they talked a lot about win above replacement. And Mike, I think currently a win above replacement is worth about $3 to $6 million. So that's right where Santana's $14 million contract comes in. He's going to have to be somewhere in that range of a 3-WAR player. Is that where you're seeing it?
It's generally considered around 5. It depends on which one you look at. When you're looking at, for me, when you're looking at things that have already happened, especially with pitchers, I prefer to look at Baseball Reference. They're based more on the things that have actually happened, whereas Fan Graphs, they tend to look at what should have happened. So you're looking at, what's a typical batting average in balls in play? Okay, well, let's change it to that and see how they project. And then, you're taking a look at, okay, how many homers, and all these complicated figures that aren't that complicated. But they both agree on Santana. Fangraphs has him as a 3-WAR pitcher. Baseball Reference has him at 2.9. So I think, I think 3 is just fine to say. And that's a good starter level. So I think with that, I think somewhere in that $14 million range is fine. And with teams having to give up a draft pick for him, I think that depresses it a little bit. Now, I would say, Bob Dutton was still talking about the Royals a little bit because Mariners fans were asking about Santana. And basically the industry experts say that, okay, Santana's probably going to be around 3 years, $40 million, and it might be even less than that. And then Dutton also said something, he could possibly return to the Royals on a 1 or 2 year deal. And so, when I think of that, okay, well, how do you fit him into this team's payroll? And maybe you mess with the numbers to where, okay, maybe he's only going to be getting $10 million this year, and maybe you pay him $15 million next year or something. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to work out. I would lean towards they're probably not going to sign him. But I think if he did get $14 million a year, he'd at least be worth it the first year of the contract. Now, as he gets older, you've got more chances for him to get it hurt. You've got more chances for him to blow up. As Jeff said, he's been inconsistent. So, there is a possibility that he doesn't reach that goal. And that's kind of what he has to do. So either he has to be a guy who's better early to kind of make up the value that he might lose later, or he's got to be more consistent. So I think that 340 is probably about right there. So that's about kind of where you have to stick him. But it's about $5 million per win above replacement, and Santana's pretty much right in line with that.
Well,
so can a team ever really get value out of a contract like what Kershaw got for the $217 million? I mean, can they ever really see the WAR from that? That's a lot of money to cover. That's what, 8-9 WAR a year?
Sure, but if he's an eight WAR player the first 3 years of it, that's an additional 6 that you can tack on later. So the overall value of the contract works out. And that's kind of like with the Mariners, what they were banking on with signing Robinson Cano to that deal, is that they're going to get the value from it up front in the first half of the contract. And the second half, it's going to start to decline. And that's kind of, I think, how they approach it. I think a lot of teams are approaching contracts that way. At least it seems that way. It seems that the bigger contracts, they're understanding that they're not going to get the value on the back end. They're going to have to get it on the front end as kind of a surplus for that year.
So, Mike, this is something I don't know. When they say, one win above replacement is worth roughly $5 million. How do they figure that $5 million part?
Basically, you take, zero WAR player is somebody that you could sign as a professional free agent. It's not just anybody off the street, but it's like somebody who's played at the professional level, or somebody you could call up from Omaha, or AAA or what have you. and they could perform, you know, right there at that baseline. And so you have to figure that baseline, and then you have to figure relatively how much better players are. And it kind of, it moves a little bit. And I think as salaries go up, you're going to see that the value of a win above replacement is going to change. Just because, I mean, it has already, where, you know, different years it'll be a little different, just because it has to, because the money's getting bigger.
Okay, because that was ultimately going to be my point, was that the $5 million, that it's like, okay, it's kind of circular logic, you know, you're saying, oh well, one win above replacement is worth $5 million, so if he's a 6 WAR player, then he's worth $30 million. It's like, well, the only reason a win above replacement is worth $5 million is because someone like Clayton Kershaw is getting paid $30 million, and that brings all the averages. You know, I mean, the point being that you can't, it's not quite as cut and dried as it seems, because the fact that there's the money is so out of control, it's inflating that wins above replacement value. Whereas if you were in a situation where, you know, I mean, the salaries weren't nearly as high, then you might have, you know, it might be $1 million per win above replacement. And then you're like, yeah, okay, well, Clayton Kershaw's getting way overpaid. And how do you justify that? You know, so it's kind of the salaries that are already being paid, regardless of the wins above replacement, factor into how much it is. So it's kind of misleading when you think about it like that. So this can go back to that future discussion we'll have on out of control salaries in baseball, but I think that's important to note as well.
Yeah, and on that note, I mean, it could be possible that by the time Clayton Kershaw's contract is up and he's in that last year, maybe a win is $6.5 million, and then at that point, well, then, you know, it takes even fewer wins for him to technically reach the value of it, even if he's only a 1-2 win player. Well, you know, it's still at that point 13-14 million of value versus 10 million. So it's going to move, and it's going to continue to move as players sign bigger deals and bigger extensions until something else kind of pops on it, until the bubble bursts, I guess. Which I don't know if that's going to happen anytime in the near future. Maybe not until the next CBA gets negotiated.
In years past, Dayton Moore has been accused of jumping the gun on free agency. Did Dayton Moore jump the gun this year?
There are 4 starting pitching free agents who've signed deals that get them 4 years or more. And Jason Vargas is one of them, and I would not say that he should be one of those 4. There are 6 pitchers that signed deals that guarantee them $30 million or more, and Vargas is, again, one of those guys. And I don't see him as being a top 5, top 6 starting pitching option in this market. Now, granted, that does omit Santana and Jimenez, who have not signed anywhere, so he could drop, but that still puts him top 6, 7. And I think that's just way too soon, especially for a guy like Vargas, who's just been an average kind of guy. You know, I just think they could have done something, and by this point, maybe they could go get, you know, Urban Santana for whatever amount of money they would want, they'd be able to afford. So, yeah, I think you jumped the gun. I think we've seen this before, where you sign Bruce Chen too soon, you know, and just other points where he makes a trade right away the first week after the World Series, because, you know, I don't know. We've talked about it before, about what his motivations might be. I don't think anybody's really figured it out yet.
A guy that Dayton Moore was accused of jumping the gun with, I believe it was last year, the year before, was Bruce Chen. And now Bruce goes out, he has a pretty good couple of years, and gets through and hits free agency again. And I think he was expecting to get a major league contract, but yet here he is, still just a couple of weeks removed from pitchers and catchers reporting, and Bruce Chen doesn't have a contract. At some point, do we see the Royals reach out to him and at least offer him a minor league deal? I mean, he can do either starting or relieving. It's kind of odd. So what happens with Bruce Chen?
It's kind of a bummer that he kind of hits this market where it's just so weird, and there's all these different players that have signed already, because I think what he's done with the Royals, he's probably deserved at least a shot at a major league contract, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of movement on him at all. And I guess I could see where he could sign with the Royals or any other team on a minor league deal, but at the same time, it's like he's been kind of, you know, patchworking those minor league deals for the last like 6 years and finally cashed in on one with the Royals. So I don't know. I think he might be holding out because he really wants to get that major league deal. You know, he's getting old. It's probably the last shot he has at a major league deal anymore.
So it's FanFest weekend, and I used to love going to FanFest when I lived in Kansas City. It kind of got you out of the winter lulls and got you a chance to go do something baseball in January. So I'm a big fan of it, and I know Mike doesn't really care. So I guess, Jeff, what's your opinion on the Royals FanFest?
I don't care.
I have never been, but I like, you know, I go to Comic Cons and card shows when I was younger and stuff. So I'm a fan of the fests in general, but I've never been to Royals Fan Fest. No.
You know, Jeff, all I heard right there was, man, I am into really nerdy things.
That's pretty true.
Basically, what I was trying to get across. We are on a podcast right now.
Well, I like FanFest, but I won't be able to be there this year, so I've got a challenge for all of our listeners. You want to win some Kelly's Bucks? Here's an easy way to do it. Go out to FanFest. Get any sort of Royals player, executive, anybody related to the Royals, and you get them to say this little phrase. Vote Royal Man for MLB Fan Cave 2014. Send it to me at KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com. You know, that address, you can also send anything you like or don't like about the show or anything like that, anything you want to give us opinions on the show, which will also win you Kelly's Bucks. But send us things from FanFests with players, executives, people of the Royals saying, you know, anything along the lines of vote Royal Man for MLB Fan Cave 2014, because you may or may not know, but I am trying to get into the MLB Fan Cave. And if you don't know what it is, you'll have to go online. You'll have to Google it. Just Google MLB Fan Cave. You'll see what it's all about. It's really a neat baseball experience. It's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and my life has just worked out in a way that I can actually go do it this year. In fact, I was featured on 610 Sports with Lake and Binkley today. And here's that clip that I'd like you to hear, and then we'll come right back and talk some more about it.
And welcome back to the Day Shift. Also, by the way, big thanks to Arthur Bryant's Barbecue. That's the barbecue sauce being given out.
They're hooking everybody up.
Hooking everybody up. Lake, Bank, Day Shift rolls on. Here's one of the two interviews we told you to pay attention to today. For the local ankles, well, angles. That and Betsy Johnson, of course.
Some sort of ankle thing we don't
know
about?
Yeah, like cankles and stuff. Maybe I was thinking about you, buddy. And they having the cankles, but...
And also 15 minutes away from your next chance to win in the 4K a day national contest.
Yeah, 15 minutes away to win some cash. Make sure you tune into that. But Betsy Johnson, of course, which was on Shark Tank with her in studio on Friday. She got her money. We'll talk to her in just about an hour. But now on the Van Chevy Hotline, a guy that personifies super fan, doesn't live in Kansas City anymore, but he definitely repped the Kansas City Royals. Now he's trying to get into one of the coolest things, which is MLB Fan Cave, when you can sit in there and watch every game, and he wants to represent the Royals. Our friend Troy Olson, Royal Man. What's up, Royal Man?
Nothing much, Pink. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, we're doing great, man. The quest to be in Fan Cave is pretty cool. I remember last year at spring training, they brought a lot of the people on a caravan on the Fan Cave bus driving around trying to see the teams. Now, how do they work this, Troy? Do they work it to where just one representative of each team gets put in the Fan Cave?
Well, that's the way it's been the last few years. Now, see, the Fan Cave, as I understand it, has evolved a little bit. I was interested in doing it in years past. Life just never happened to work out. But I married an amazing woman, and she got totally behind this year. And so we decided we were going to go for it this year and give it one good shot. But the first year they did it, they just put two people in. And then the last 2 years, they put nine. And the last 2 years, it's had kind of a Survivor reality show type feel to it where you get eliminated as the season goes on, dependent on how well you get clicks to the blogs you write and the other stuff you do. They eliminate people, and then the final three went to the World Series, and they named one the winner, and they won a prize. Now, the way that it works as far as we've gotten it figured out is, or the way I understand it is, right now I've got a video up, which is on YouTube, and I put a website to it so you can find it really easy. You can just go to www.voteroyalman.com or just voteroyalman.com. They both will get you there. Right now, all you can do is watch the video, maybe give it a thumbs up if you feel so inclined. And what we're trying to do is we're going to show the Fan Cave folks that Troy Olsen is the right guy for the Fan Cave. And so what will happen is they're going to narrow it down to 50. There's probably 30,000 or so people that apply for this every year. And that's how many was last year. And so fearing that number this year again, they'll narrow it down to 50. From that 50, there will be at least one representative from every team. From the 50, they go down to 30. At the 30 point, it's no longer necessarily one from each team. Last year, the Royals did have one. But you could have multiple, and there are multiple people from the Royals trying to get into this thing this year. Then they get down to 30. The 30 they'll take to spring training. You show how good you are at interviewing players and stuff like that, which for me, that's no problem because I've been doing the podcast for a while, and so I'm not worried about that part if I can get that far. So in my mind, if I can get into the top 50 and then into the top 30, it should be no problem getting into the 9 and representing Kansas City in New York City as a member of the MLB Fan Cave. So I'm really excited about this, and I do hope people go out and watch the video. And, you know, we're using the Twitter hashtags VoteRoyalMan and then following it with hashtag MLBFC2014. And we're hoping that this gets enough attention from the MLB Fan Cave people that they will put me in that house for hopefully the whole 6 months, and we can really represent Kansas City.
No wonder your wife's an amazing woman. She wants to get rid of your ass for 6 months.
You know, that might be it, too. But as you mentioned, I did leave Kansas City. Megan, my wife, has asthma problems, and the humidity was really causing havoc for her. So we moved down to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where it's very dry, and she doesn't have those problems. And, you know, we talked about it, and we were down here, and she has always supported my love of baseball. We do isotopes games and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm a subscriber to MLB TV, and she sits here in the living room while I force her to watch, you know, Royals games or whatever, because she's never been a baseball fan, and she's not originally from Kansas City or from any baseball town. And so she's always been really good about it. I have the utmost respect for my wife when it comes to that kind of stuff, because I know I'm not always the most understanding of everything she likes, and I'm not sure that
You're passionate. You're passionate about your sport. But you're passionate about the Royals fans. You wear the tights. You do the whole thing. My question is, Real Man, when you do, you said 6 months, so they're taking you away from 6 months. So what they put you up, they pay for your meals, I assume, your lodging and everything. You watch every single Royals game, or do you have to watch every Major League game?
From the way it's described, you literally sit and watch a wall of TVs that have every Major League Baseball game on. So I assume that, you know, I had a friend that was up there, but she wasn't allowed to tell me, well, a Twitter friend that was up there last year, she wasn't allowed to tell me a lot about what they do. But she did say that, you know, that they do watch every baseball game, and she was one of the final three. And, you know, they take them all over, and they have these interviews and stuff. But the way I understand it is you get up in the morning, you have breakfast, you sit down, and you watch baseball until it's over. And then they do the other things throughout the day or whatever. But it is all season if you make it that far. And they do, from what I understand, they give you a stipend. It's in the rules that they give you a stipend of some sort. Now, I was told that it's a livable stipend, but it's unlikely I'm going to get rich doing this by any means, but it is a great opportunity to showcase myself to the world for, you know, voiceover jobs and stuff like that I would love to do.
Yeah. Now, Royal Man, how much extensive prep work are you putting into your presentation? Because that is a huge part of this deal and a huge piece. And, you know, when it comes to, like, being on pins and needles, putting all of this stuff and going through the process, what is that like for you as well? Because a really good friend of mine from where I was raised and where I'm from was a member of the 2012 MLB Fan Cave. Her name is Lindsay Getzel, and she worked diligently she was a former intern on my previous show, and she worked hard to put her stuff together, and she actually was a part of the Man Cave for half a season. Like you mentioned, they do eventually kind of, you know, dwindle it down in terms of the numbers. But when you talk about being a part of being in the NYC and the free concerts and the people that come and visit you in the Man Cave and all the celebrities that kind of stop through, this is an awesome deal, man.
Yeah, it's really cool, and I hope to God that I can make this. It would really be a dream come true. It'd be a real chance to do something that I've never done before. People have urged me to do it in years past, and you know, life just didn't work out then. And with our moves this year to the Southwest and things not just panning out as we'd planned for my employment, this is the right time. And I'm a Christian, and I do believe that this is, you know, the one chance I'm going to have. And if it's God's wish for me to do this, then I will go on, and I'll represent Kansas City proudly. And, you know, Bink mentioned my super fan days, and, you know, I'm not out there repping at the Royals games anymore in the tights and the cape. In fact, I'm not even sure where most of the costume is anymore. The cape lives in my closet, but that's pretty much all that's left.
Oh, you got to bring the cape back out.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'm ready. But if I make the fan cave, I'll take the cape with me for sure, and we'll have it so we can go down the slide a few times when they do hit the home runs at the K or on the road. I guess it's more likely on the road. But, no, I'm excited. And, you know, you're talking about the prep work that goes into this, and I have to give a shout-out to a good friend of mine, Chris Kamler. You guys know him on Twitter.
Fake Ned.
As the Fake Ned. He's the guy that is the voiceover on this. He also is the one that helped me do all the production on it, getting it all together. My wife went out and did the videos that you see in the video again at footworldman.com. We went through, we did all this, and Chris had, you know, Chris helped me with my vision of what I saw. We helped to get it just right, to get it narrowed down. And Chris Candler is a class act, and you may not think so when you see him on Twitter and some of the hijinks he does.
Ah, no, Chris is awesome, man. He does great video work and everything else. Fake Ned is amazing with the video camera. At KC Royal Man, if you want to follow our friend Troy Olson on Twitter, help this man get into the fan cave, because I want to hear all about it. I'm a huge sports fan, of course. Know you are too. This is a lifelong dream to be in the MLB fan cave. I wish you nothing but the best, buddy.
Well, and you know, I think the same for you, Binkley. It's great to hear you on the radio every day, because I'm excited every day when I hear you. I'm just as excited as I was the day that we were standing in that parking lot and you told me you got the job with 610.
All right, brother.
I thank the world of you. And folks, go to VoteRoyalMan.com and hashtag VoteRoyalMan for hashtag MLBFC2014. Thank you guys so much for having me on.
Yeah, good luck, man. Good luck. I heard it's an awesome experience. I know people that have been a part of the MLB fan cave, so... Yeah, he's going to be super pumped if he gets there, but it is a long process.
Hey, 105 degrees, 110, there was Troy in his Royal Man suit. It had to have been hot as hell, but we wish him the best of luck.
Yep.
So thanks to Lake and Binkley for having me on. But yes, I'm going to try to be the first Royals fan to make it into the fan cave. Right now you can go to www.voteroyalman.com. Just watch the video, give it a thumbs up if you want, but that's all we can do right now. Hopefully I'll make the top 50 and then the top 30, and once I start getting that far, then there's more you can do. But you can also, you know, make sure you think and visit the sites that are helping me on this process. Craig Brown, great friend of ours from Royals Review, he posted on his site. That's the biggest Royals blog that's out there right now, and he was very helpful to us.
He missed the shift meeting at Best though.
Ah, yes, the All-Star Game shirts.
You weren't at the BP event during the All-Star break last year.
Yes, you must have been there to understand what he was referencing there. Those shirts were pretty awesome, though, and I give Kamler credit
they
for
did.
That.
I like them, though. But
well, you know what's funny about those shirts? We had both the KC Baseball Vault and the Royal Man Report logo on there back when we were Royal Man Report podcast and the Baseball Vault was just a 1510 show. We were like, hey, why'd you put the Baseball Vault on the chest and the Royal Man Report on the sleeve? Now it actually makes more sense since we're the Kansas City Baseball Vault full time now. Huh? How about that?
Yeah, how about that? I guess he was predicting the future and didn't even know it. You know, we try to keep our off-season shows to around an hour, especially when we don't have a guest, because it's the off-season. And right now, especially with you getting so many shows on this RoyalsPodcast.com feed, you know, and I think it's fantastic, and I hope you guys do too. You get us, you get Triple Play, you get Walk Off Talk, and of course, Pine Tar Press. And so we always try to keep these to about an hour. So on that note, we'll make a quick hit here on... Justin Maxwell did get signed to a deal. It was part of arbitration. It's not much. Mike, what do we take away from that?
Like $1.3 million. Good for him. We'll see if he makes the team out of spring training. The Royals signed John Roush to a minor league deal. It's a lottery ticket, and he's 6'7". But what we really, really want to finish with is telling you about the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame, who inducted a former Royal and basically a guy who spends a lot of time at the K. Mike McFarland, former catcher, who seemed to every year lead the team in homers with about 15, which is pretty bad. He was inducted, but our good friend Bob Kendrick, who does so much for Kansas City and the Negro League Baseball Museum and keeps, you know, the history of the game alive and that part of the history of the game alive, does so much stuff, and he's helped us out, and, you know, any time we get to talk to him, it's just, you know, the best day we can have. So he's going to, you know, he was inducted into that. I think they gave him about 2 minutes to give his speech or something, which is, I think he tweeted that it takes him 2 minutes to say good morning, which if you've ever talked to Bob is more than true. We just wanted to be sure to recognize that because he's helped us a ton with so many different things, and he's always available to talk with us, and he's always got something going on with baseball in Kansas City. So congratulations to both of those guys.
And on that note, I think that covers everything we need to talk about for this week. So we'll be back next week with another show. Hopefully there will be some Royals news in the meanwhile. But until then, check out the rest of the shows on RoyalsPodcast.com. Find us on Stitcher, iTunes, all those great places. Get me those clips. Send them to KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com with any other comments you have. But until next week, for Mike and Jeff, I'm Troy. Go Royals.
I think we should shoot for about 7 minutes tops on this next one.
If that.
I want to eat some food.
Yeah, I need to go hang with my girlfriend.
Yep. Yeah. I'm going to go play some games on my tablet. It's about the same
also
thing.
Also fun.
Yeah. Watching Parks and Rec.
Never watched that show.
I saw the pilot and I didn't like it, and so I never got back to it, and now I like it. So first season's kind of rough.
Yeah.